TNT Sport Pods.
2006 should have been one of the great years in Hearts history. Scottish Cup winners and league contenders, but off the pitch the club was in complete chaos. On today's Curry Club, the Scottish Football Sessions, we go behind the scenes of the Vladimir Romanov era with two former captains, Stephen Presley and Michael Stewart.
Stephen, Michael, I've been looking forward to this episode. I can imagine there's some incredible stories to be told about Vladimir Romanov, that period at Hearts. But before we get into all of what he did at the club and didn't do, just put me in context, everybody watching and listening as well. The situation at the club, if you remember it, back in 2004, 2005, when Vladimir started to buy shares, it was a precarious time, wasn't it?
It was a precarious time. The support was turning on the club. There was obviously a lot of speculation about the club's future at Tynecastle. You know, it had been put up for sale, and I think it was at the time Callum Holmes had done a deal, and it looked like we could play at Murrayfield. So it wasn't a particularly happy club. It was quite a divided club at that time. They were obviously looking for somebody to take the club over and then, you know, retain their rightful place at Tynecastle.
Yeah. I remember, I'd come in on loan at the start of the season, and, you know, as Elvis is saying there, it was financially in a difficult position. I came in on loan. I just was desperate to come home, and I'd said, like, look, I'm not going to take any, you know, money. I'll just play for free. No. Well, unfortunately, the club had been spending their whole budget on Elvis's contract, so there was no money left. So, yeah, famously, I think I ended up getting paid £1 a week.
Oh, yes, I know this now.
I took my wage from Man United at the time and just wanted to come home and play. So I was, to a certain extent, I was oblivious to a lot of these things that Elvis is talking about. But very quickly, I got a sense of how financially precarious the club was and how desperate they were for somebody to come in and save them. Because moving away from Tynecastle would have been an absolute disaster for the club.
When you think about the stadium now, yes, and the way it looks now and what it still gives them on the biggest nights, it would have been maybe a disaster for the football club. They needed a saviour, as Michael says. Vladimir Romanov is a man that tries to step forward, and he's slowly buying more and more shares at this point. What was the first you heard of Romanov coming into Hearts, the first meetings maybe you had with him? What do you remember of that time? Because at that time, he was welcomed with open arms.
Of course he was. I don't remember a lot other than, you know, I remember Craig Levine was actually the manager at the time, and Craig, I think, had an opportunity to go to Leicester. Craig spoke to me about that because, you know, I think at the time he was concerned about the future of the club, which direction, also a new owner coming in, would the new owner really want to keep him? You know, what sort of stability did he have? So there's a lot of uncertainties about, you know, Craig and his future. He'd done a particularly good job, but like all managers, when a new owner comes in, you're always concerned. So he just said that, you know, that the new owner was coming in, you know, that there was talk of real investment in the club and hopefully exciting times ahead. And, you know, that's really, you know, the first I heard of it. And then, you know, it was all change after that. You know, obviously Craig leaving, Vladimir coming in, and then John Robertson returning. So it changed very, very quickly.
I can remember having a conversation with John Robertson.
In fact, yeah, sorry.
And it was pretty much similar, very similar to what Stephen's talking about there, where John had said, you know, he'd put forward ideas to Vladimir about what he was looking to do, players he was looking to bring in, money to be spent, and he says he just kept powwowing it. He was going, no, no. And it was just like, well, can you give me an idea of what's sort of going to be spent? Better than this, more than that. And it was just like, I've got no idea, you know, what is actually going to happen. Yeah. And I don't think anybody internally at the club had any clue what he was going to, you know, embark on.
No. Well, the 04-05 season you're talking about, you were on loan. Mm-hmm. You obviously leave the club, you end up across the other side of the city. So you're still seeing this secondhand, if you like, from a different perspective. But that 05-06 season then, a lot of players started to arrive. as you know. I'm sure at that point you must have spoken to Romanov a few times yourself, and some of these foreign signings that were coming in. You start the season under George Burley in incredible fashion.
You start the season with about three players in pre-season, first of all.
Yes.
Well, if you want to take me back to June or whatever, you can.
What I would say is that it was interesting. From the Craig Levein period through the John Robertson period, we'd built the nucleus of quite a good squad. Yeah. You know, it was four or five what would be international players involved in the squad and several other good young players that were emerging. And then, of course, George comes in, but George comes in with what was his assistant, but really head of recruitment, a lad called Simon. Yeah. And Simon started bringing in a lot of players from the Czech Republic and various other countries. And you could just feel the excitement building day by day.
Yeah.
And during the course of the pre-season, of course, not just that, the George Burley appointment was a huge, huge appointment. You've got to remember, George, 3 or 4 years prior to that, had won English Premier League Manager of the Year. So we're talking about a really high-profile manager being attracted to Hearts at that time. And then the level of the signings brought a real excitement and optimism to the club in that pre-season.
There was a feel-good factor. I mean, but you remember that they were short on players at that point.
I do, because obviously I was still speaking to a lot of the guys, and it was, you know, Craig Gordon was there, Robbie was there, and there was early at the start of pre-season, there still was that sense of what's going to happen. You turn back up for pre-season and there was like a handful of guys, and quite quickly it started to get pieced together.
Some good players arrived.
Yeah, very good. And, you know, looking from the outside in, you could really sense quite quickly that there was no mucking about. It was a team that was going to really cause a lot of problems and do very well.
Well, they won their first eight games that season, undefeated in their first 10, Celtic being the last, I think, of that run. I don't know if you felt title contenders. In that dressing room, did you feel at that point there's a real chance you could go on and win the title?
There was a definite feeling of optimism. You know, I think the Celtic game was a massive game. We'd also beat Rangers prior to that, you know, at Tynecastle. Yeah. So, you know, we'd built up an amazing degree of momentum, and we also were a really physical, strong team. And as I said to you there, we had the nucleus of a good team. We had strong personalities within the dressing room. So I did feel at that stage we had a real chance. You know, I think that during the course of the season, and once you've been through it, that you need to experience these moments and grow with these moments before you can say that you're going to win the league. And it probably was early as a team for us.
But the fans were definitely
excited.
Everybody
was excited. Yeah. You know, and it would have been really interesting, you know, to see what would have happened if George had remained in charge. There's no doubt that his departure really derailed us. And I think as well, you know, had a real effect on some of the foreign acquisitions that we had, because they had come to the club because of George and because of Simon's relationship with them. So, you know, I think it had a real adverse effect with them.
When did you first find out he was gone? And what was
quite
your
reaction? Amazing. I turned up on the, well, you know, I'd heard murmurs after the Celtic game that there was problems. And they were about his substitutions that day. You know, we'd gone to Celtic Park, we'd drawn the game 1-1, but by all accounts, after the game, Vladimir had a meeting with George and told George that if he'd made these two substitutions, we would have won the game 3 or 4-1.
If he'd read the fax machine.
Yeah, if he'd read the fax machine, exactly that. Of course, which George disagreed with. So that was after that, and it obviously just built up over the course of the next couple of weeks. And then George departed. I remember going in on the Saturday morning prior to the Dunfermline game, getting taken into the office by a couple of the Lithuanian employees and just explained the fact. And the amazing thing was, I always remember this, there was 3 Manager of the Month awards on the shelf. He'd won them all. It was quite amazing. And from there, it definitely derailed us. There's no doubt about it.
I mean, it must have been even shocking being a Hibs player at the time, but to be reading and to be seeing and speaking to players in the dressing room that they've sacked George Burley at that point, Michael. I mean,
well,
was there disbelief?
The whole of Scottish football was like, what's going on? Because I don't know if you remember, but it was, and Elvis is talking about the physicality of the side, it was literally those games were won inside like the first 20 minutes.
Yeah. Blown teams away. As well.
Yeah.
Just blown teams away. Early goals, quick starts, dominating teams. And, you know, you think to yourself, a few short months into the season, it's always been, you know, brilliant. You genuinely do look in from the outside and think, that's a team that's going to be difficult to stop. And then they sacked the manager. It was pantomime stuff.
And when you say that, Michael, it was very much the George Burley way. Yeah. You know, at that time, he was all about very aggressive football, very much front foot football. We got the ball forward early, pressurised teams, we squeezed up on teams. It was very much his way.
Guys like Rudy Scatchell and Takis Fisas, you know, you're talking about, like, Rudy, I mean, I've never seen somebody be able to hit the target, like, so often. I mean, it was incredible. You know, literally, it was every time I hit a shot, it was like a rocket, and it was on target. It was either a goal, or the keeper was having to pull off an unbelievable save.
When you go back to the game that George, you know, his first game that he missed, the Dunfermline game, I always remember Takis being a Greek. You know, he was like a Greek.
He's won the European Championships.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, he was like a Greek philosopher, and he said to me, "Listen, my friend," he said, "this is all going to end in tears."
He saw the future.
I thought you had to be a philosopher to figure that one out.
Had you spoken to Vladimir Romanov by this point?
No, not at all.
So he still hadn't addressed the players, because he was building up his shares at this point, as you know, and he was taking full control of the football club. But do you believe George Burley had full control over the players that were coming in, the what was happening around the first team? Was that a question at the time?
I think there was he had a degree of control, but I think there was a degree of compromise as well, because you had the likes of Jankauskas coming in, you had what was the other two Lithuanian players?
Mikalauskas and Chesnauskas. They'd come before.
Yeah,
you know.
But that was definitely a Vladimir. Yeah. So I think there was a case of, we'll allow you to bring in this player, but you need to bring
but
in that player.
But you know, Elvis, you know, you're talking about Jankauskas and Mikalauskas and Chesnauskas. Jankauskas, in terms of as a compromise, the guy had been playing at Porto. You know, he was a top player. The problem was then that was the precursor for what was to come after that. And when, you know, even when I came back, you were still being, you know, flooded with Lithuanians that were just simply not good enough.
It was a whole different regime at that point. Obviously, there was a lot of pressure from above, but Roman Romanov came into the club as well. He obviously had a big say in signings. But after George left, there was this period where, I don't know if you remember, at the time I was a youngster kind of getting into the press. All these names in the back page of the paper, Kevin Keegan, I think Sir Bobby Robson, there were so many names linked with the football club, top managers from around Europe. Was there still a feeling of, OK, look, George has left, it's a bit of a disaster to lose somebody who had you going in the right direction, but was there also a feeling that this might end well?
There was obviously that hope, but I always remember receiving a phone call from, it was from Graham Ricks, and Graham phoned me to say to me, could I meet him? I can't remember the name of the hotel, but it was really the day before that he was going to be announced, and I remember meeting him. You know, we got on really well, but he just didn't have that presence, that kind of big manager presence.
It was a controversial
and he was a really, really good person, a really lovely guy, but he just didn't have that presence, that charisma that I think George carried at that time, and I think the squad needed at that time.
He certainly didn't have the control, as we found out later on down the years. But again, you must have heard the names that some of the candidates, Claudio Ranieri and others, Otmar Hitzfeld, I think, was one of the ones mentioned, Michael, still, other side of the city. But you must have been thinking, what can Hearts achieve here?
Yeah, I know, but to be honest, at that stage, it was self-inflicted, shooting themselves in the foot, to sack George Burley. And you were sceptical, I would say, when you were hearing all these, you know, names. It was very much a, well, we'll wait and see, you know, and it clearly did not transpire to be, you know, what you would have hoped for. There's peaks and troughs throughout the Romanov tenure, but I don't think there's any question that was the peak of such an early
time. I think as well it demonstrated when Graham came in that type of managers that he would employ was going to be managers where he could influence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of, I think George was a manager he couldn't influence, and I think that's why it ended so abruptly. Yeah. And then the Graham appointment was very much, this is what's to come.
In that January, I think 11 new players arrived. I mean, that was a ridiculous transfer window for you, wasn't it? Players were coming left, right and centre into the club at that period. And obviously, Vladimir was leading the charge.
By the way, though, there were some very good players still, because obviously when I came back to the club, you still had the likes of Bruno Aguiar, José Goncalves.
A team that went on to win the Scottish Cup. It wasn't a terrible season. You finished second as well.
Second in the league.
And you win the Scottish Cup. So even though you can probably feel within the football club that chaos is reigning here, you still go on to have a good season.
Yeah. But the issues were that there was absolutely no plan in place. It was just sign players.
Scattergun.
It was scattergun approach.
You were relying on
talent. I don't know if you've ever been in the dressing room at Heriot Watt, but it was a big dressing room. It was a big dressing room, and this is no exaggeration. The day, I think, was the 1st of January after the transfer.
Like this.
No, it was a massive dressing room, but they had to add additional benches down in the shower area and in the bath area to accommodate all the players. And see, after that, we actually had such a large squad with two first team groups. Yeah. Now, how do you create a unity and a spirit within that?
That was a challenge for some of the players. Was it after the January? Did you have meetings at that point with Romanov? Or you were certainly unhappy? I remember there was a lot of stories in the press that you wanted to lead almost a delegation of players to go and to speak to the board, if you want to call them the board. Was that around about that time, or was that after? Well, I know in October, the famous press conference, but before that?
Before that, the reason that we did was to do with Graham. Now, Graham, as I said to you, maybe wasn't a presence, a manager in that respect, but he was a good guy, and he'd been treated so poorly and dictated to by those above. And I think we'd played Dundee United and lost the game. I can't remember exactly what game it was, but the rumours were that he was going to be sacked. And it was all around the Andy Webster situation.
Remember with Andy?
Well, they didn't want to play Andy. Yeah. He did play him, and he was going to be sacked. Right. And on the back of that, I led four or five of the more senior players to go and meet Vladimir. And
what happened?
He gave him more time on the back of that. I think he was going to sack him, and we said that this is wrong, this can't happen, gave him more time.
So he would listen occasionally to you?
To a point, but it was inevitable.
What were the conversations like, Stephen? Give us an idea, because you know the sort of image he has now, apart from the fact at the end he left the club in ruins, clearly, but of almost this madness and this... you know, one day I think this, the next day I think the complete opposite. Was that what he was like to deal with?
But that was the problem. You actually could have quite a civil conversation, and Michael will tell you that. The problem was you could have that conversation and then the following day it was different.
I think you've agreed something.
Yeah, you've agreed something. You know, my job ended up being with a lot of the players and staff to actually go and see him, because this was a common occurrence. You'd be told something, it'd be different the next day.
And the Andy Webster situation you just mentioned, was that brought about by the tensions behind the scenes? Because obviously it didn't end in a particularly nice way. They stopped playing Andy because he wanted the freedom of contract, didn't he, at the end of the season. Did he want to get out of the club, did you feel, because of what it was, or did he just have a better offer?
I think a bit of both. Right. I think the chaos, he could see what was happening. And, you know, opportunity to go elsewhere, you know, probably to a more stable environment.
You remember that playing out in the press as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course I do. You know, and it just all fed into the feeling of a place that was destined for, you know, some form of disappointment. But, you know, I've got to say, along this time, though, all during this time, you're talking about a team that was full of good players. You know, that was the main thing. And I always felt, you know, and one of the big reasons why when I had the opportunity to go back, I wanted to go back, was because it just felt like, and this was the big frustration, Stephen will tell you the same thing, you just felt like, look, if you can just let a manager, like, manage the club, there's a good team that will be able to do something. Like, when I went back, and eventually when I was captain of the club, as Elvis said, you'd speak to Vladimir, and I liked the guy. You'd have good conversations with him, and my feeling was that he was surrounded by the wrong sort of people that were there for their own interest, filling their own pockets and telling them what he wanted to hear. And when you felt like you had an agreement on something, you know, like Elvis said, it would change later, I always felt was like it was others that were influencing, you know, what he was eventually doing.
You felt the same way, I assume, Stephen. You saw other people surrounding him.
No, absolutely, and I think Michael's right. I think there was a lot of agendas within the club. A lot of people within the club that wanted to make money from the club also. You know, I said to us earlier, the day that I left the club, you know, I got brought into Valdas's office. Actually,
well, this was Valdas Ivanauskas.
This was Valdas who was in charge. Well. Yeah, he was in charge at the time, and he brought me into the office the day that I was told that I was to move out. But Valdas brought me in, and I think on Vladimir's instruction, and then offered me the assistant manager's job.
This is after the famous record in three. The press. This is now the next season, following season. You've won the Scottish Cup. This is October, I think.
Yes, this
of
is
2006.
October. Not long after I made the famous, you know, statement.
The record in three.
But the day that I had scheduled for a meeting down at the stadium about my future, Valdas had called me into his office and said to me, look, we'd like you to be assistant manager, of which I had to refuse. It went against all what I was standing for. But my point is, then an hour later, I went down to the offices at Tynecastle and were told that I had no future left at the club. And that kind of told me the situation within the club. There was an agenda. And I think that those within the offices, those that worked behind the scenes, I think they felt that I had too much power and influence, and it affected decisions that they wanted to make, and in the end they got me out.
BT Sport Pods. There was effectively two office staffs. You had the Scottish staff and you had the Lithuanian staff. Now, literally, it was like two clubs in one. So, you know, whatever says you would go down to Tynecastle, you know, and like you would want to go and speak to somebody, and then you'd maybe bump into one of the lists and you'd go, no, come here. And they'd try and, like, you know, like disrupt or just agendas, basically. And it's dysfunctional. It was never going to work.
I could certainly say that again. Just to take me back then to what we've just mentioned, the famous Rickerton Three. At what point did you go and speak to Paul Hartley and Craig Gordon and others? Were you trying to make sure you had at least a couple of players, significant players next to you on that day? Were they on side with you right away? No problem, we'll be with you, sort of thing?
Yeah, I'd asked several others, but I'd explained to others, actually, the likes of Robbie and those, that weren't on big money at the time, had families, and I spoke to them, and I'd asked them, but also I'd said to them, look, it could affect your future, and if you don't want to put, you
that
know,
must have been hard, actually, for
line.
A lot of players.
Of course it was.
You had the support of the dressing room, but publicly it's difficult, isn't it?
Well, that's it. And I had to choose the correct ones, of course. And Paul, you know, if it didn't work out, he was going to have another opportunity. Craig was definitely going to have another opportunity. So these were two guys that, you know, they weren't gambling on their future. So I had to be careful with that. And I totally understood that others may not want to put their neck on the line, but were very supportive. The reason being is it had just been a continuous, you know, situation where there'd been lies and deceit to everybody. And we're not just talking at this moment in time, it was assistant manager was coming to me with his problems. You know, we're talking about me having to deal with every aspect within the club. You know, and it became tiresome for me. It became...
Did you know, as soon as you were speaking that day, addressing the press, you assumed that was the beginning of the end for you?
No, I actually didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't. I actually hoped that it would create a situation that maybe we got some stability and some common sense in the club. And, you know, I'm being serious on this. Vladimir never challenged me about the situation after that. He never came to me and asked me, what are you doing? He didn't. I had no issues after that. He spoke to me like nothing had happened. And like I've said, you know, on the day that I left, I was offered the assistant manager's job. And that's why there's certain things that don't sit right with me on the whole thing, because I genuinely did it in the hope that they could see some sense here. Because at that time, it was utter chaos. You know, when you look at some of the stories, I don't know, Michael, but when I think back at some of the things that we were doing, I remember there was almost a witch doctor came in.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know
pajama
if you experienced.
Was this
not in a pajama, that one. It was a pajama.
Is this still
man.
Under Ivanauskas?
This was a lady that I believe that Vladimir had an illness and she had cured his illness. Something about this. So he had put total faith in her. So what happened was, she would come in and see on a Friday, she had this machine you'd put your finger in, right?
Yeah.
And the machine would tell you whether you were fit or not to play the following day. It was a great
Did
thing.
Did it take any blood or anything, or was it just...
No, just you put your finger in, right? And it would tell you if you were fit or not. A brilliant thing for the manager, because... Brilliant thing. because he didn't need to let people down.
Do you think Vlad had already decided before the finger went in who was going to be playing at the weekend?
I think that was it.
This had progressed to, like, when I came back in pre-season, it was no longer just one finger. It was like a ghetto blaster, right?
This is the following summer.
You put your two hands into where, like, the CDs would go, and it was the same thing. And this was Pyjama Man, who was, like, standing there with a computer at the side, and it used to just, like, there was, like, a silhouette of, like, your body, and then it would just go like, whoa, whoa. And then you were nearly like a trainer. You were nearly like,
oh. That was the following summer, right? But in between, you leave the football club. After Ivanauskas, Mally Orfeev comes in. What was it like training under Edouard when he came in? Because obviously that was clearly the selection of the owner.
Yeah.
Did he even want the job? I'm not sure. But
listen, during my 20 years as a player, it was probably the most bizarre training period of my life. You know, we didn't play any small-sided games. We hardly did. In fact, we did no tactical sessions. We would go out.
Because he spoke no English.
Yeah, we would go out. We'd do star jumps. We'd do squats. We would do... Actually, we did play games, but the games were what you called, like, you joined arms. You had to run about in twos with joined arms, and you could only kick the ball with your left foot. And there was also wheelbarrow football. You name it, we did it.
What was the wheelbarrow football?
Your partner would have your legs. You'd be on your hands, and you'd have to flick the ball with your hands against each other.
And I loved handball.
This was the end of your period at the club.
I loved handball as well. Yeah. He used to play handball all the time, Malafif. When I went back in pre-season, and he reappeared. Yeah. And the guys that were obviously still there, they were just like, oh my Christ, please no.
I've never seen anything like it, but this joined arm football, this was amazing. Yeah. You had to get your partner, join arms, run about with arms, and you could only use one foot. It was crazy.
So, look, obviously, Paul Hartley, we know, eventually moves on. Craig Gordon gets his big move after it, but you're kind of shown the door, aren't you, in the end? How did you got a great move. You went to Celtic. Yeah. How did you feel at the time? Because you've just said you went into that press conference hoping that you might bring a degree of calm, that people might listen. In the end, you're effectively pushed out the door. Was there sadness that you were leaving the football club? Was there frustration because you knew you were leaving some good characters and some good players in that dressing room as well? Never mind the fans who had been put through it.
I think there was huge disappointment for me. And I know, you know, I obviously got a good move on the back of that to Celtic, but that certainly wasn't my intention. I had in place a testimonial. I'd been 8.5 years at the club. I'd in place a testimonial in the following season. It'd been promised to me. I probably had a career pathway there where I would have gone from being a player to being a coach and developed there. So there was a lot of things, a lot of sacrifices I made. Mm. And
do you regret doing it then?
I do, yeah. I do. The reason I regret doing it is that you often do things with intention and you think something's going to come off them, but you never get any thank yous for it.
No.
You know,
you put your neck on the line.
Yeah, I put my neck on the line. And from a career perspective, you know, I've said this to you before, when you go to play for Celtic, you play for Rangers, you play for Hearts, you don't become the most popular person in Scotland. That's why I don't live there anymore. But you don't, you know. And
you've upset them all.
I've upset them all. But I'd, from what I got out of it, listen, I did it with the best intentions. I'm a guy that has very high values and morals. That's why I did it. I didn't like what I seen within the club. We had a brilliant dressing room under Craig Levein, under John Robertson. You know, there was some really good people within that club that were being treated horribly. And I did it. But when you say, do I regret it? Yes, in the sense that it did me no favours. But no, in the sense that I did it for the right reasons.
Mally Orfeev, the next manager, and you say he reappears during that summer. So everything Stephen's just said, this is now the football club that you are rejoining, because you signed in the summer of 2007. There's a famous summer tour as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot you remember about what went on that summer.
Oh, incredible. The one thing I do remember, and Elvis I'll remember Tam Ritchie, who was the fitness guy. Tam, I was never a huge fan of Tam. But he was, and I don't mean in terms of personal, just he was very, very like busy and worked hard as a fitness guy. And I always remember when I came back Tam was the first sort of person, you know, to greet and say, oh, how are you doing? Great, brilliant. He went, it's a different club now. This is not the same club. This is not the same club you left. I was like, all right. And then very quickly during that summer, it was just like, oh my word.
Had you seen anything like it?
No, it was mental.
You'd been at Man United.
Yeah. I mean, it was proper, like, off the scale. But the other thing that just I kept clinging on to was that the calibre of player that was there. You know,
still.
Yeah, because, like, you know.
Despite the departures.
You had the likes of Bruno Aguiar, Karapidis, Goncalves, Pinilla. You know, Pinilla's like part owned by Inter Milan, Chilean international striker, you know. And we're doing all these things that Elvis has talked about. And these boys obviously knew. And when Malafif turned back up, they were just like, you could just see them thinking, oh, please, no, no. And it was, you know, in the Alps pre-season. And you literally at the end of the day, you couldn't even move because he's like, you know, it's like Soccer AM, the Eastern European sub warm-ups, star jumps, forward rolls, you know, like piggyback, you know, Cully Bucky's run down, then you had to swap over and get back. And then handball, they just loved handball all the time. And the Liths used to love it. Like they used to love
it. So you were great at handball.
Oh, great at handball. I mean, they couldn't kick the ball from here to there, but they could throw it brilliantly, like half the length of the football pitch. Yeah. And just never spoke a word English. Just used to scream like rushing at the side of the park, you know, "Bisla, bisla!" And you're like,
what did you feel was ahead then that season? Because no idea. There was good players.
There was no manager. This was the other thing. So Anatoly Korobotchka, who was technically meant to be the manager, but he didn't want to manage. You're trying to speak to Anatoly and say like, what's going on? Like, you know, this is mental. So he was like, he would listen, you know, and you would get the sense that he got what you were trying to say. And
you're like, experience.
Yeah, and the boys that were obviously there before, they were like, he cannot come back. Like Malafif, it was like, why is he here? And Anatoly was sort of saying, well, he's the man, you know, and he's like, no, he can't manage. Like, because when he'd been at Hearts, it was like 9 games and he hadn't won a game.
Yeah.
And the guys were like, no, he can't come back.
Was this the summer?
This was the summer. It's amazing how your memory sort of plays tricks on you. I do believe it was the same summer.
It was
in the Alps, but then we went to Vienna and we were in the hotel in Vienna. We were going to play Austria-Vienna. And Vlad had come to the hotel to give one of his inspirational speeches beforehand. And he was talking about how, you know, when he was growing up, he was a wee hard man and he used to fight, you know, he had to scrap for everything. And he was a boxer. And Roman, just Bednar, in a sort of toss-away sort of comment, was just like, you know, you bet you weren't very good or something like that. And Vlad just looked at him and then just carried on talking. So you didn't think anything about it. So anyway, we played the game against Austria-Vienna. And after the game, I'll never forget, Vladimir comes into the changing room and he's got 2 sets of boxing gloves in his hand. He'd gone into the Vienna town centre, he'd bought these 2 sets of boxing gloves, and you could just see Roman's face just like that. What? And he chucks a pair of gloves at him and he goes like, not very good. And then he was like this, out into the car park. So,
and by the way, the press are there, cameras are there.
Yeah, so it was behind a fence, yeah. It was still sort of inside the stadium in the car park. Yeah, there's press kicking about, but nobody really knew what was going on. But we've all like just walked out, like thinking, what on earth is going on here? And Vlad's got his like sleeves rolled up, he's got his boxing gloves on, and Roman's obviously like, reluctantly going like, but what am I meant to do here? So like Vlad's basically like putting his gloves on for him. He's like, get them on. And you know, Roman's a big guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big boy, and then.
Oh, it was Le Mans v Mountain. I've seen the video. It was incredible.
And he's in the car park and Vlad's like jumping about, you know, like ready to start boxing him. And Roman's not wanting to throw a punch. And eventually...
Punching your sack, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. And eventually Vlad like catches him with a beauty.
He does.
And you know, Roman's sort of like stumbling about and we're all going, couldn't stop laughing.
If anyone's not seen it, by the way, and they're watching or listening to this, you've got to have a look online. Because you're right, he catches him with quite a good punch.
He does.
And there's a moment when I'm watching this video back, as I was before this podcast today, you see the red mist descend over Roman's eyes.
Then he quickly realises, I can't do that.
Well, someone jumps in, though. He kind of backs away.
Larry Kingston jumps in. But I think Larry was just like, you know, he was just like, this is brilliant. Yeah. But
if he hadn't done that, though, you do wonder where that was going to end.
No, we were winding Roman up just saying, you bottled it. But the club, because there was a few folk had filmed it, it was on the cusp of, it was social media wasn't there, but you'd send messages.
Yeah.
So there was starting to be like a few folk back home had been like, what the hell's been going on out there? And it started to sort of get out a wee bit. So the club then, they released it like on the website because they knew this is going to get out. So
they were trying to control this
narrative of the owner and like the striker having
Was that also the same summer as Barcelona? When you play in a friendly with the only reason I say this, because you mentioned Anatoly Korobotchka, and he, I think, has since spoken or done some sort of memoirs or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I have since read this, and he claims that he thinks the end of his time, really, for Hearts was when he never played Vlad in a pre-season match against Barcelona, when apparently Vladimir Romanov asked to go on the bench and wanted to play. You can believe it, can't you?
Ah, oh, without a doubt. You know, there's no doubt about it. But just when Michael's talking about pre-seasons there... After the year that we won the Scottish Cup...
Was this when you were on the yacht?
Yeah, I actually got a picture sent to me about a year ago from who was the masseur at the time, was a boy, Alan Robson. He sent me the photos from the boat. Yeah, from this trip. We'd obviously won the Scottish Cup and he had promised us some form of bonus or holiday or what have you as a group, but never really materialised. And then in pre-season...
You're in Monaco.
We flew into Monaco and stayed overnight in a hotel, and then the following day we're on the bus coming down into the marina, and there's like top level yacht sitting there, and then there's almost this cruise ship, and we're all joking saying, wonder whose that is, and of course we pull down, it's for us. We are talking like top
billionaire's row,
incredible. And we spent that pre-season, we spent something like 10 days on
the doggies on the deck.
Yeah, but
seriously, you were there for 10 days.
Something like 7 to 10 days on the boat. It was only us on the boat.
Was this meant to be a celebration or a
this
reward?
Was like a celebration, but also it was our training camp. So we spent the 7 to 10 days cruising the French Riviera, stopping off at various
places. It sounds
places.
Great, by the way.
It was unbelievable, and just training at various camps. But this was the sort of thing that he'd done. You know, when that happens, you know, he kind of did things that made you think he has some serious money behind him.
Yep.
You know, these were the sort of things that made you think, wow, how rich is this guy, you know?
Well, obviously you're a couple of years further down the line, you've come back to the club, you stayed for 2 years, didn't you, at that point? I think you've actually said that you stayed for 3 years, that's right, till 2010. That actually, as much as massive mistakes were made...
Yep.
This could have been an even better time for the football club.
Oh, it could have been.
If the money had been used in the right way, this could have been incredible.
Well, exactly. Because of everything that Elvis is talking about there, you did have a sense of there was serious money being spent. You know, the club effectively was losing money, and he was like, he was bankrolling it. But you look at what's been done. You know, there's numerous examples of clubs that benefactors come and spend a lot of money, build the infrastructure, build the club to then be able to grow the turnover, to be able to sustain itself. So, yeah, you look at the things that were done and you think to yourself, if it was done in a proper way, then you could have got the club... You know, where the club is now is in a very strong footing. They've grown the club brilliantly.
What they've Hearts done now is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. But I always felt like he could have done something like that if he'd spent the money in a sensible way, rather than... I mean, I remember like when we were there, he had this madcap idea about launching a luxury sportswear brand. It was like Romanov Revolution or something. And they had decked out in one of the main bars in town. It was full of, like, you know, fans, and they had like a female and a guy face model. It was a competition. There's a catwalk. They've got all the media, and I think she was a relative. I can't remember her name from back in Moscow. She was launching this brand, and you're thinking to yourself, nobody is going to buy this stuff. And the gear was murder. And they've got these folk like walking down the catwalk, and you're thinking, how much money are we wasting on this?
The problem is, obviously, we know the story now towards the end. The money he was financing the football club, but we don't really know on the basis of what, because in the end it all collapsed. Financially it collapsed. But in between that, Michael, even your time there, I think you've since told me you could have gone back to the football club around about 2012. Yeah. There were still good times. Shabba Laszlo had, you know, some good, some bad times. Paulo Sergio was loved by the fans. The 2012 Scottish Cup against Hibs, one of the great days, still kind of overseen by him, if you like.
Well, when Shabba came in, that was certainly, from my perspective, it was a proper manager. So there was this sort of legacy of good players that were still there, contracts coming to an end, a manager who actually knew how to coach, and you were thinking to yourself, right, well, just invest a wee bit more again. He didn't, and then it sort of peters out. To relate back to, obviously, Webby's time where his contract was running down, that was a constant thought amongst players, was that if it was known that you were going to be leaving, then you weren't going to play type thing. My contract was coming to an end. So I didn't really want it to be known that I was going to leave, but I was still open to hearing what was going to be happening. And, you know, just a quick story about that. Sergei Fedotovich, who was like one of Vlad's guys that was running the club. I remember Sergei was like, right, we want to negotiate a new contract. So I was like, yeah, I'm open to it. I was trying to like sort of just drag things out a little bit. And he wasn't always there. He'd come and go and, right, I'm here in 2 weeks' time. So I was like, right, okay. So he phones me and goes, come to the Tynecastle, we want to talk about things. And I was like, okay. So he came down and he says, we've got an offer. And I went, right. I says, well, put it in writing and I'll go away and I'll talk to my lawyer and, you know, have a wee think about it and look over and we can start negotiations. And he's just sort of looking at me with this blank face. He went, I'm away tomorrow. And I was like, right, okay, well, when are you back? He went, 2 weeks. I went, okay, well, draw it up and I'll come and we can start talking. So he phones me back up 2 weeks later. And he goes, right, come down to Tynecastle, Michael. I've got it in writing for you. So I was like, okay. So I went down to Tynecastle. I went into Sergei's office, and he's got this laptop here. And I walked into the office, and he's just like this. And he looks up and goes, I'll be back. So he walks out of the office, and he comes back with an A4 sheet of paper, nothing on it other than like four lines. The first one was length of contract, 3 years plus one. Wage, appearance, bonus. That was my contract. I was like, right, I'll go have a wee think about it. I mean, that was like, it was like nonsense.
And what year was that?
That was like 2010. Right. Not so long before I left.
Sport pods. You could have stayed on. You could have been part
stayed,
of it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if that was
if that was real, was that another one of the 2 days later you never hear again?
Oh. It was just, you know, I mean, not, I mean, that's I'm trying to give the idea and see here that things were just done in such a ludicrous way that you were like what is that? Like, it's just crazy.
Listen, 17 managers were sacked in 8.5 years. I think that's the number I had to try and calculate.
You've got to think, we're a game away from the Champions League.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually do believe that if the games hadn't been at Murrayfield, I think we'd have progressed. I genuinely feel that. We were such a strong team at Tynecastle. You know, we'd beat, I think, the Bosnian champions to get through to the game before the Champions League group stages itself when we played Ike Athens. Yeah. Who at the time were a good side, but not beyond, you know. Well,
Murrayfield was definitely not helping. When I was there originally, and we were in the group stages, and the games were at
Murrayfield,
and we played against Schalke, Ferencvaros. I think. Well, to be fair, we had actually some not bad results, but
we had good results.
But Murrayfield, like you're talking about, you know, you'd have maybe 25,000-30,000 there. It's, you know, it's a huge stadium. We filled it for the Barcelona pre-season friendly, mind you, but it's not. It was definitely I would agree with Elvis there that Tynecastle is such a positive and a benefit for the club.
A unique
that when
stadium.
You go and play European games at Murrayfield, it's not intimidating for the side.
You obviously you love the club, you know Hearts. You've obviously you stay in Edinburgh as well, so you've seen everything that's happened even after you left. You from afar at the time, it was an absolute travesty at the end, wasn't it? Because the club were left, I think it was June 2013, administration, there was a real fear again at that point, and you must have felt this. I think you might have been at Falkirk or something by then.
No, it was Coventry, actually.
Coventry.
Yeah.
You must have felt a club that at one point that was close to your heart as well, they were crumbling, and there was a real chance at that point the club could have gone under.
No, very much so. You know, they were hours, I think, from potentially going under. And
I remember the press conference, the administrators were saying.
Absolutely, it would have been an absolute travesty. But thankfully, you know, they've been taken over by somebody that has great intentions for the club. I always remember as well, Craig phoned me. I was on the bus on a Saturday going to a game with Coventry, and he actually asked me, it was about Robbie at the time. He asked me what I felt at the time, whether Robbie could certainly do the job. And thankfully, I said yes.
I say that.
So, but I do. I remember that. And it was his first spell at the club. And again, it was a terrific spell.
I mean, look, Robbie has done incredibly well for Hearts. The thing that you need to recognise here as well is that when the club were at its lowest ebb in terms of, you know, administration, almost going out of business, Anne Budge, of course, has stepped up. It's the fans as well. You know, that's the thing now.
I was about to say that.
It's incredible.
You needed a saviour again in Anne Budge. But the way, the plan she put together, the backing the fans, put their hands in their own pockets, Michael.
The backing
that's
still...
Unbelievable what the football club managed to do at that point.
That's still happening just now. You know, it was a wonderful, you know, plan. It was a really inventive idea. And it has worked a treat in terms of, you know, the business side of it. Now, thankfully, the football side of it is working out really well. Robbie's at the, you know, the helm of that, and they've got the infrastructure in place. That's the thing that Vlad never really, he never invested in the infrastructure. So much money was spent on wages.
Yachts.
you know, trying to get Elvis to stay. but now you see, as I said to you before, like if it had been spent properly, I think you could have got the club fast forward to a position where they are now, potentially even further ahead, because the level of investment was astronomical. But the disappointment, obviously, that it was left in such a bad state, the fans have stepped up to the plate, and now, you know, the foundation of Hearts, the, you know, they own the club, the money they're still putting in, it allows the club to, you know, get to the position where they're in the European group stage football, which brings more money. So that's, like I said before, you grow the turnover
sustainable,
and then it becomes sustainable, which is great to see.
It almost feels fitting to me that Robbie's the man back in the job that's taken them back into Europe. Does it feel a bit like to you it's come full circle now and your old club is in a good place again?
Very much so. You know, I think when Robbie left, he felt it was time to leave. I don't think he was fully supported at that time.
Absolutely.
I think that they thought that somebody else could take the club on to the next level, and it proved to be not the case. And I don't think in his first stint at the job, he did a remarkable job. We've got to remember, he won the championship when it was at its strongest, with Rangers
Absolutely.
And Hibernian both in the championship at the time. And then he had a third place finish, I think, in his first season in the league, which was quite remarkable. But again, I think people underestimated his managerial credentials. Now, I think as well, and I don't just mean those in the background, but I think the supporters underestimated the job that Robbie
Absolutely.
Had done. And I think it's only now that they're beginning to appreciate what he achieved the first time around and what he's already achieved the second time.
He left too early.
Yeah.
He left too early.
I'm not sure he did, Michael, because I think at the time, you know, people had said there would be no more investment in the team. I think he'd felt that he needed investment to go in the next stage. But I think that behind the scenes that some people thought that
he can't take them to the next level. They did. But when I say that he left too early, like, my point is that clearly the dynamics behind the scenes weren't right. Thankfully, he's been able to get back to the club and things have changed and he's been able to progress the club. I just felt, you know, and perhaps in hindsight he would privately say this, is that, you know, to leave Hearts and go to MK Dons when he was still very early in his tenure at Hearts, I think it was too early. But thankfully, he's now back. The club's in a, you know, much better position in terms of the actual squad, the foresight of where they're needing to go to, and European group stage football, the chance this season again, you know, of being able to progress with that carrot of, if you win the Scottish Cup or you finish third in the league, you've got European group stage football again.
You have to go again, you want to go again, of course, but it's not been all plain sailing, as you know, even the second time back at the club after the disaster in the Scottish Cup. I mean, I remember the fans were asking the questions again, Michael, but Robbie had to turn things around, and he has, and like I've said, maybe it is fitting that he's the man to do it. I mean, as we obviously, as we record this now, as we talk now, the club have totally turned around, and it's almost role reversal. As I say, Robbie, first time round, part of the shambles that was progressing, the financial collapse, and now he's back there, leading the club at a time where the financial situation, thank goodness, Touchwood, is in a great place.
Absolutely.
A much better place.
I think the key to any successful club is stability. You know, stability of staff, stability of players, and not an overhaul. Everything we've not talked about.
11 in January, etc. Yeah.
You know, everything we've not talked about under the Vladimir reign. You know, and I think that was the most challenging thing under Vladimir reign, was that absolutely no stability or continuity. And finally, they're getting that with Robbie just now.
What a crazy 18-year kind of story, if you want to call it, almost 20 years in. I mean, as I say, we do these long discussions on football clubs, and that is particularly that 8 years of Vlad. It will go down, I think, Michael, do you agree, is one of the craziest, most remarkable chapters ever in Scottish football?
I don't think there's any doubt. But what I also think it shows is that with some real hard work, investment and foresight, there's an opportunity to create a little bit of history.
Yeah.
Because the duopoly of Scottish football with Rangers and Celtic, it very difficult to break it down. But when Vladimir first came in and it looked like he was going to do it, it caused some real shockwaves. And I think that in itself is good for Scottish football.
I think the last time the Old Firm were split.
Absolutely. I think you've got to remember as well, within that, he did some great things. Transfer record fee on Craig Gordon for a British goalkeeper that stood for a very, very long time.
Yep.
I find it hard a wee bit to say that everything... You know, he did some good things. Yeah. And I guess even Hearts fans would find it hard. I know exactly what you mean, because you saw it firsthand. But given the end, it almost feels hard to say...
He kept Hearts at Tynecastle.
He did. And that was the good. But in the end, it was unfortunately almost the financial ruin. So it's
absolutely.
It's kind of... You're torn in a way to say it, if you know what I mean.
I don't know if you remember when he was in and he had these mocked-up models of what Tynecastle was going to look like, the new stand that was getting built.
Well.
I mean, some of them are, and the thing was, you just never actually knew. Yeah. So if that gets done, that's right. And then it was like, next year.
He had the plan in St Andrew's Square to open UKO Bank.
Yes.
You know, I remember the building.
Yeah, it was next door to Glen Eagles. Glen Eagles have opened up next door to the building he owned. He owned it.
I think that's a good way to end it. There was some good, a lot of bad under Vlad, but what a story. Guys, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it. Cheers, Stephen. Thanks. Michael, cheers. Thank you.